From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Here are the facts. After the people of Ukraine mobilized popular protests and calls for reform, their corrupt president fled. Against the will of the government in Kiev, Crimea was annexed. Russia poured arms into eastern Ukraine, fueling violent separatists in a conflict that has killed thousands. When a civilian airliner was shot down from areas that these proxies controlled, they refused to allow access to the crash for days. When Ukraine started to reassert control over its territory, Russia gave up the pretense of merely supporting the separatists and moved troops across the border.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama last week at the 69th U.N. General Assembly in New York as we continue our coverage at the United Nations. This past Saturday, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, got his chance at the podium. His statement included a direct and detailed rebuttal to each of President Obama's claims.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, there is growing evidence today of a contradiction between the need for collective and partnership efforts in the interest of developing adequate responses to challenges common to all of us, and the aspiration of a number of states for domination and a revival of the archaic bloc thinking based on military drill discipline and the erroneous logic of friend or foe. The U.S.-led Western alliance that portrays itself as a champion of democracy, the rule of law, and human rights within individual countries acts from a directly opposite position in the international arena, rejecting the democratic principles of sovereign equality of states as enshrined in the UN Charter, and trying to decide for everyone what is good and what is evil. Washington has openly declared its right to the unilateral use of military force anywhere to advocate its own interests. Military interference has become a norm, even despite the dismal outcome of all operations of force that the U.S. has carried out over recent years. The sustainability of the international system has been severely shaken by the NATO bombardment of Yugoslavia, intervention in Iraq, the attack against Libya, and the failure in Afghanistan. Only due to intensive diplomatic efforts was the aggression against Syria prevented in 2013. There is an involuntary impression that the goal of various color revolutions and other projects to change unsuitable regimes is to create chaos and instability. Today, Ukraine has fallen victim to this arrogant policy. The situation there has revealed the remaining deep-rooted systemic flaws of the existing architecture in the Euro-Atlantic area. The West has embarked on a course towards vertical structuring of humanity tailored to its own far from inoffensive standards. After they declared victory in the Cold War and the so-called end of history, the U.S. and the EU have opted to expand their geopolitical area that is under their control, without taking into account the balance of legitimate interests of all peoples of Europe. The Western partners did not heed our numerous warnings of the inadmissibility of violating the principles of the UN Charter and the Helsinki Final Act, and time and again they have avoided serious joint work to establish a common space of equal and indivisible security and cooperation from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. The Russian proposal to draft the European Security Treaty was rejected. We were told directly that the legally binding guarantees of security are only meant for the members of the North Atlantic Alliance, and at this time they continue to expand to the east in spite of the promises that were earlier given to the contrary. The instantaneous switch of NATO to hostile rhetoric and to the drawdown of its cooperation with Russia, even to the detriment of the West's own interests, and the additional buildup of military infrastructure on Russia's borders, revealed the inability of the alliance to change its genetic code, which had created during the Cold War. The U.S. and the EU supported the coup d'etat in Ukraine and reverted to outright justification of any acts by the self-proclaimed Kiev authorities that opted for suppression by force of the part of the Ukrainian people, which had rejected attempts to impose throughout the country an anti-constitutional order and wanted to defend its rights to its native language, culture, and history. It is precisely the aggressive assault on these rights that compelled the population of Crimea to take its destiny into its own hands and make a choice in favor of self-determination. This was an absolutely free choice, no matter what was invented by those who are primarily responsible for the internal conflict in Ukraine. In general, attempts to distort the truth and hide facts behind blanket accusations have been undertaken at all stages of the Ukrainian crisis. Nothing has been done to track down and prosecute those responsible for the bloody February events at Maidan and the massive loss of human life in Odessa, Mariupol, and other regions of Ukraine. The scale of appalling humanitarian disaster provoked by the acts of the Ukrainian army in southeastern Ukraine has been deliberately underscored. Recently, new horrifying facts have been brought to light when mass graves were discovered in the suburbs of Donetsk. Despite UN Security Council Resolution 2166, a thorough and independent investigation of the circumstances of the loss of the Malaysian airline over the territory of Ukraine has been drawn out. The perpetrators of all of these crimes must be identified and brought to justice. Otherwise, it will be difficult to count on national reconciliation occurring in Ukraine. Russia is sincerely interested in the restoration of peace in this neighboring country, and this should be well understood by all who are even slightly acquainted with the history of the deep-rooted and fraternal ties between these two peoples. The way towards political settlement is well known. Last April, Kiev already took upon itself an obligation in the Geneva Declaration of Russia, Ukraine, the U.S., and the EU to immediately begin a broad nationally inclusive dialogue with the participation of all regions and political forces in Ukraine with a view to carrying out constitutional reform. The implementation of this obligation would allow all Ukrainians to agree on how to live in accordance with their traditions and culture, and would enable Ukraine to restore its organic role as a binding link between the various parts of the European space, which naturally implies the preservation and respect by all of its neutral and non-bloc status. We are convinced that with goodwill and the refusal to support the party of war in Kiev, which is trying to push the Ukrainian people into the abyss of national catastrophe, a way out of the crisis is within our reach. The way to overcoming the crisis has been opened with the achievement of the ceasefire agreement in southeastern Ukraine on the basis of initiatives by Presidents Poroshenko and Putin, with the participation of the representatives of Kiev, Donetsk, and Lugansk, as well as the OSCE and Russia. Practical measures are being agreed upon for the successive implementation of these agreements, including the separation of the parties to the conflict, the removal of the heavy weapons of the Ukrainian army and militia forces, the setting up of monitoring through the OSCE. Russia is prepared to continue to actively promote the political settlement under the well-known Minsk process as well as other formats. However, it should be crystal clear that we are doing this for the sake of peace, tranquility, and the well-being of the Ukrainian people, rather than to appease someone's ambitions. Attempts to put pressure on Russia and to compel it to abandon its values, truth, and justice have no prospects whatsoever for success. Allow me to recall some history from not so long ago. As a condition for establishing diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union in 1933, the U.S. government demanded of Moscow guarantees of non-interference into the domestic affairs of the United States and obligations not to take any actions with a view to changing the political or social order in America. At that time, Washington feared a revolutionary virus, and these guarantees were put on record. And this was on the basis of, of course, reciprocity between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Perhaps it makes sense to return to this topic and reproduce the demands of that time of the U.S. government on a universal scale. Why would the General Assembly not adopt a declaration on the inadmissibility of interference into the internal affairs of sovereign states and the non-recognition of a coup d'état as a method for the change of power? The time has come to completely exclude from international interactions attempts to exert illegitimate pressure by some states on others. The senselessness and counterproductive nature of unilateral sanctions is obvious if we look at the example of the U.S. blockade of Cuba. The policy of ultimatums and the philosophy of supremacy and domination do not meet the requirements of the 21st century and run counter to the objective process of developing a polycentric and democratic world order. Russia is promoting a positive and unifying agenda. We always were and will continue to be open to discussion of the most complex issues, no matter how unsolvable they may seem to be in the beginning. We will be prepared to search for compromises and a balance of interests, and even to exchange concessions, but only if the discussion will be truly respectful and equitable. The Minsk agreements of 5 and 19 September on the ways out of the Ukrainian crisis, and the compromise on the timeline of the entry into force of the association agreement between Kiev and the EU are good examples to follow. As is the declaration, finally, of the readiness of Brussels to begin negotiations on the establishment of a free trade agreement between the European Union and the Customs Union of Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan, as had been proposed by President Putin back in January of this year. Russia has consistently called for the harmonization of integration projects in Europe and Eurasia. The agreement of political benchmarks and timelines of such a convergence of integrations would make a real contribution to the work of the OSCE on the topic of Helsinki Plus 40. Another crucial area of this work would be to launch a pragmatic discussion, free from ideology, about the political and military architecture in the Euro-Atlantic region so that not only members of NATO and the CSTO, but all countries of the region, including Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, would experience equal and indivisible security and would not have to make a false choice of either with us or against us. New dividing lines in Europe must not be allowed, even more so because in the era of globalization, these lines could turn into a watershed divide between the West and the rest of the world. It should be stated honestly that no one has the monopoly on truth, and no one is now capable of tailoring global and regional processes to their own needs. There is no alternative today to the development of consensus regarding the rules of sustainable global governance in new historical circumstances. With full respect of the cultural and civilizational diversity of the world and the multiplicity of models of development, it will be difficult and perhaps a tiresome task to achieve such a consensus on every issue. But the recognition of the fact that democracy in every state is the worst form of government except for all the others also took time to break its way through until Churchill proclaimed his verdict. The time has come to realize the inevitability of this fundamental truth in international affairs, where today there is a huge deficit of democracy. Of course, some will have to shatter centuries-old stereotypes and abandon claims to eternal uniqueness, but there is no other way forward. Joint efforts can only be built on the principles of mutual respect and taking into account one another's interest, as is the case, for example, in the frameworks of the UN Security Council, the G20, BRICS, and the SCO. The theory of the benefits of collective work has been reaffirmed by practice, and this includes progress in the settlement of the situation around the Iranian nuclear program and the successful conclusion of the chemical demilitarization of Syria. On that point, speaking of chemical weapons, we would like to receive authentic information on the state of the chemical arsenals in Libya. We understand that our NATO colleagues, having bombed this country in contravention of UN Security Council resolutions, would not like to stir up the mayhem that they created. However, the problem of uncontrolled Libyan chemical arsenals is too serious to turn a blind eye to. We think that the UN Secretary General has an obligation to show proof of his responsibility on this issue as well. What is important at this point is to see the global priorities and to avoid holding them hostage to a unilateral agenda. There is an urgent need to refrain from double standards and approaches to conflict settlement. Generally, everyone agrees that it is a key issue to resolutely counter terrorists who are attempting to bring under their control increasingly broader territories in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, the Sahara-Sahel area. That being the case, this task should not be sacrificed to ideological schemes or the desire to settle personal scores. Terrorists, no matter what slogans they hide behind, should remain outside the law. Moreover, it goes without saying that the fight against terrorism should rely on a solid foundation of international law. An important phase in this battle was the unanimous adoption by a number of United Nations Security resolutions, including those on the issue of foreign terrorist fighters. And to the contrary, attempts to contravene the charter of our organization do not contribute to the success of joint efforts. The struggle against terrorists on the territory of Syria should be organized in cooperation with the Syrian government, which has clearly stated its readiness to join it. Damascus has already shown its capability of cooperating with international programs when it participated in the destruction of its chemical arsenals. From the very beginning of the Arab Spring, Russia called for it not to be left to extremists and for the establishment of a united front to counter the growing terrorist threat. We warned against the temptation to make allies of almost anyone who proclaimed himself an enemy of Bashar al-Assad, whether it be al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, or other fellow travelers seeking regime change, including ISIL, which today is in the focus of our attention. As the saying goes, better late than never. It is not for the first time that Russia is making a very real contribution to the fight against both ISIL and other terrorist factions in the region. We have sent large supplies of weapons and military equipment to the governments of Iraq, Syria, and other countries in the Middle East and North Africa, and we will continue to support their efforts to suppress terrorists. The terrorist threat requires a comprehensive approach if we want to eradicate its root causes, rather than be condemned to react only to the symptoms. ISIL is only a part of this problem. We propose to launch, under the auspices of the UN Security Council, an in-depth and broad study on the extremist and terrorist threats in all of their aspects throughout the Middle East and North African region. This integrated approach implies also that the long-standing conflict should be considered, and primarily those between the Arabs and Israel. The absence of a settlement of the Palestinian issue over several decades remains and is widely recognized, one of the main factors of instability in the region, which is helping the extremists to recruit more and more new jihadists. Another literally urgent area of our common work together is the joining of our efforts to implement the decisions of the UN General Assembly and Security Council to combat the Ebola virus. Our doctors are already working in Africa. There are plans to send additional humanitarian assistance, equipment, medical instruments, medicines, and teams of experts to assist the UN programs in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The United Nations was established on the ruins of World War II, and it is entering the year of its 70th anniversary. It is an obligation for us all to celebrate in an appropriate manner the anniversary of the great victory and to pay tribute to the memory of all who perished for freedom and the right of each people to determine its own destiny. The lessons of that terrible war and the entire course of events in today's world require us to join efforts and forget about unilateral interests and national electoral cycles when it comes to countering global threats to all humanity. It should not be allowed for national egoism to prevail over collective responsibility. Thank you.
During his presentation to the General Assembly last week, President Obama also spoke about the situation in Syria.
The terrorist group known as ISIL must be degraded and ultimately destroyed. This group has terrorized all who they come across in Iraq and Syria. Mothers, sisters, daughters have been subjected to rape as a weapon of war. Innocent children have been gunned down. Bodies have been dumped in mass graves. Religious minorities have been starved to death. In the most horrific crimes imaginable, innocent human beings have been beheaded with videos of the atrocity distributed to shock the conscience of the world.
On Monday, Syria's foreign minister got his turn to address the assembly. Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualim spoke in defense of his country and told the 193 member countries how he believes the president's approach to terrorism is flawed.
Mr. President, many events and significant transformations have taken place since I stood here last year. They surprised many of the countries present here today, but they did not surprise us, because we have been over the past 3.5 years warning and reiterating our warning so that we don't reach this stage that we have reached now. Speeches from this platform were about economic and political crises that we have been waiting from the international community to solve clearly, but maybe speaking about these issues now is no longer a priority. What we are witnessing for a few months is far more dangerous than all the political and economic crises which have happened in the world. We have spoken on more than one occasion and more than one podium, the risk of terrorism which is striking Syria. We said that this terrorism will not be confined within the borders of my country, because terrorism has no borders. This extremist ideology does not acknowledge anything but itself, and does not recognize anything but slaughter, murder, and torture. You are witnessing today, ladies and gentlemen, you can witness what the ISIS is doing, which is the most dangerous terrorist organization unrivaled in the whole world in terms of funding and brutality. What is doing to Syrians and Iraqis of all spectra and religions. They enslave girls, they rape them, they rape women, and they sell them in slave markets. They cut heads and limbs. They teach children slaughter and murder, besides destroying historical and cultural monuments, as well as Islamic and Christian symbols. All of this is happening before the eyes of the entire world, that is being witnessed by all things which they say that they are fighting terrorism, even though they have not tasted the scourge of terror themselves. Today I stand here to ask, ladies and gentlemen, hasn't the time come for all of us to stand as one in the face of the serious menace of terrorist takfiri ideology worldwide? Has not the moment of truth arrived for us all to admit that ISIS and al-Nusra and the rest of al-Qaeda affiliates will not be limited within the borders of Syria and Iraq, but will spread to every spot that it can reach, starting with Europe and America? Should we not learn the lesson from what happened in previous years and bring together international efforts to stand in the face of those organizations in the same way that those takfiri organizations have rallied themselves from all corners of the earth and brought them to one spot to train and arm and re-disseminate their ideology and terrorism through those extremists? Those extremists back to whatever they originated from. Someone might say that a resolution under Chapter 7 was passed unanimously to stop the expansion of this organization and other organizations and to eliminate them. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is true, it's better to arrive late than to never arrive. Indeed, this UN resolution adopted on 15th of August 2014 came too late. But the question, whether everyone is serious to implement it? But since its adoption, we have not seen any serious move to implement this resolution. We have not felt any real sense of danger to work on its basis on the part of regional states, of any regional states, that they still provide all support to these terrorist organizations. On the contrary, what we have witnessed on the part of the U.S. administration is a practice of double standards and alliances to score certain political agendas, particularly through supporting them with money, weapons, and training for these groups that they call the moderate. This is a real recipe for the increase of violence and terrorism and the bloodshed, and Syrian bloodshed, and prolonging the Syrian crisis and demolishing the political solution. This behavior creates a fertile ground for the growth of those terrorist groups that commit the most heinous crimes on Syrian territories, which requires all of us to seriously and effectively address and eradicate this terrorism in order to reestablish security and stability in Syria and the region. The enslaved women are looking forward to us to see what we will do for them, their sisters, their children. The sons and daughters of the victims beheaded by ISIS are waiting for our actions and what we will do in the face of these atrocities committed daily by this terrorist organization, Wa al-Nusra, and others. Ladies and gentlemen, combating terrorism cannot be done through unimplemented UN resolutions. The intentions here have no place. Fighting terrorism is achievable through actual implementation of resolutions, and it is certainly possible through military strikes, but most importantly, is to stop the states that arm, support, train, fund, and smuggle arms for those terrorist groups. We have also to drain the resources of terrorism, striking terrorism militarily while some states are continuing their support. This will cause a whirlpool of which the international community will not exit in decades. Military attacks should coincide with the implementation of Security Council 2178, adopted on September 24, 2014, under Chapter 7. We have pressure on to put pressure on countries that render all multifaceted support to those terrorists. These countries are well known to all of us. Most importantly, to pressurize those countries that exported and are still exporting this extremist and takfiri ideology that poses a grave danger to international peace and security. ISIS is an ideology which metamorphs into an organization supported, armed, and trained in order to be unleashed like a monster against Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. Let us together stop this ideology and its exporters. Let us simultaneously exert pressure on the countries that joined the coalition led by the United States to stop their support of these armed terrorist groups. Only then combating terrorism militarily becomes a viable process. Otherwise, our presence here will not amount to the level of the tears of the captives, the enslaved women, the children who fell victims to ISIS and Nusra Front and others. Once again, the Syrian Arab Republic reiterates that it stands with any international effort aimed at fighting and combating terrorism and stresses that this must be done in full respect of the lives of innocent civilians and within the frame of full respect for national sovereignty and in conformity with international conventions. At the same time, the Syrian Army would like to thank all the countries which refused and rejected any prejudice to the sovereignty of other countries and stressed on the respect of international resolution. It is high time, ladies and gentlemen, that we gather all our efforts against this terrorism, since imminent danger is surrounding everyone, and there is no country that is immune to it. My country was and still is firm in its position that was announced in the 80s of the last century regarding fighting terrorism before it becomes rampant. Mr. President, in Syria, respect our commitments and honor our promises and pledges. This was what we confirmed on more than one occasion, particularly since the beginning of the crisis in Syria. Syria agreed unconditionally to attend Geneva II and participated in its deliberations with an open mind, although we were convinced that the solution of the crisis should be a Syrian one taking place on Syrian territory. However, and as a goodwill gesture and to stop bloodshed of Syrian blood, we went to Geneva only to find a delegation that does not negotiate on behalf of Syrians. Originally, that delegation has no influence at all on the ground in Syria and has neither popularity nor legitimacy among Syrian people. It was a delegation negotiating with the Syrian government while following the orders in its Western masters, a delegation that does not believe in combating terrorism or confronting it. Furthermore, it was a delegation that does not respect Syria's sovereignty and its territorial integrity, a delegation that verbally refuses to ask terrorist groups to end their terrorism. We know that this opposition and that this delegation would not pressurize anyone, neither armed groups nor any Syrian faction on the ground. We went to Geneva, ladies and gentlemen, with a priority based on combating terrorism because we believed and continue to believe that we cannot start any political solution while terrorism is still rampant in Syria. There were some who opposed us in Geneva, recognizing this terrorism as a priority, although it is a paramount part of the Geneva Declaration provision. But the delegation of the so-called coalition continued to reject any point tackling or terrorism. Now, all the international community adopting our perspective, our view that fighting terrorism is a priority above all priorities.
Tuesday's newscast will mark the one-year anniversary since we began doing CPR News. And we'd like to thank you for listening, and we'd like to thank your stations for carrying CPR News. I'm Don DeBar. Thanks for listening.